This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio, heard weekdays from noon to one. Now, Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Good afternoon and welcome. It's Monday, time for our Zoomer Squad. And since we last talked, we got the official word on PharmaCare. The initial phase will cover diabetes drugs and contraceptives. But if you're looking forward to this, you have to wait. The provinces have to sign on to the deal. The Liberals hope to get it done by the end of the year, but Quebec and Alberta have already said no. This affects mostly people under the age of 65 when a lot of provincial drug plans kick in. And we're learning about another hurdle for that age group. A new poll finds more than half of Canadians nearing retirement are realizing that their savings won't be enough to cover their costs, let alone their bucket wish lists. And it's spring cleaning season. Now, trying to donate your unwanted stuff is a lot tougher and more fraught than it used to be. And I want to talk about my frustrating experience with a chatbot while trying to rent a van to move stuff. And one of the things that bugs me is that if there's any problem, I'm a baby boomer, so, you know, you say, well, it's because of your age. Well, it isn't, because this was done through a phone. I know how to operate a phone. It's the bot's fault. We'll talk about that later. I'm sure that a lot of you out there have had similar experiences. The numbers to call, 416-360-0740, toll free 1-866-740-4740.
And now, time for the Zoomer Squad.
And now I'm joined by Rudy Boutignol, president of CARP, Anthony Quinn, chief community officer of CARP, and Daryl Bricker, CEO of Ipsos Public Affairs. Hello and welcome to you all. So no surprise on what we learned about PharmaCare. What do people think, Daryl, about the way it's structured? I mean, does it look like a first step to full PharmaCare, or maybe just one of the many pilot projects we have?
They don't know. And the truth is, how could they know? Nobody really knows at this stage of the game. And I think most Canadians, the way that they look at it is it's just another communication from Ottawa. Until they actually see an effect in their day-to-day lives, they really won't know how to evaluate it. And at the moment, the level of trust in the federal government is very low. So I don't expect that this is, you know, causing parades one way or the other in any Canadian communities at the moment.
You know, that is very interesting, because we've all seen the polls and the reports that show that there are a lot of people who miss drug doses or taking their medication altogether because they can't afford it, because they have to choose between drugs and eating or drugs and heating. And diabetes drugs beyond the very basic ones can get very expensive, Rudy, and it's an epidemic.
Well, listen, PharmaCare is a great idea. This just happens not to be the thing that's going to deal with it. It's everyone needs access to essential medications, but the Liberal NDP proposals, it's not a healthcare plan. It's a political strategy to maintain power. It's great on an announcement, but not on details that people need, you know. And for CARP, it needs for older adults, it needs collaboration with the provincial governments, because there are existing plans in place. And CARP, for instance, has been pushing for all NASHI approved vaccines to be free, something that's really important for the general public and older adults in particular.
I don't know how they get away with calling it a PharmaCare plan, Libby. If they said we have a health care plan that does tonsils and ingrown toenails, we wouldn't call it a health care plan. And now they've picked two, and I'm certain that they're important for certain sectors of society. But Canada has a PharmaCare plan in place right now. Over 40% of people are covered by provincial plans right now. Another 40-something group of Canadians are covered by workplace plans. So there's this 15% of Canada who benefits from this kind of program, but it's not solving anyone else's problems.
Daryl, does that play into the lack of trust in the government?
Yeah, it does, because if the promise is that it's PharmaCare, but which sounds very broad, and then what's delivered is actually fairly narrow, then the public reaction is why that and not this, and particularly if it's somebody else who's taking another type of drug that's really expensive in which they don't have coverage. But it did accomplish the two things that it needed to accomplish. One, gave the federal government a good announceable, and the second thing that it needed to do was make sure that the NDP stayed in cooperation with the federal government, which they've decided to do. So that's ultimately what the whole thing was about.
I guess what you're saying is, you know, it was put, or the government tried to market it as, well, it's a first step. It's just a first step. It's what we can afford now, not that we have seen any exact numbers on it. So, Daryl, again, people aren't buying that, right?
Well, we don't. Again, it's, if you went out and you asked people, do you think we should have a national PharmaCare program, you probably get half the population saying yes. But going into the actual specifics of this one and what the potential cost would be is another question. And then the other part of it that we always fail to ask on too many surveys is, do you actually think that this will be delivered as it was stated? In other words, 2 years from now, do you think this thing will be in place and you'll be able to get all the services that they promised in the announcement? And that's where the real cynicism starts to kick in. And it's it's cynical referring to it as cynicism. It's actually more just the disbelief and based on experience.
Well, one of the things that I keep harping on is that with this government, it takes forever between an announcement and the thing itself actually materializing. Sometimes, not only do you have to elect them once, you have to elect them twice. With the increase in old age security, it took two additional elections before people got their top-up of money. And so you can certainly understand why people are skeptical. This time around, I think it's more electoral politics. If the polling numbers hold up, Justin Trudeau is extremely unpopular, and Pierre Poilievre and his Conservatives are surging, and it's, I guess, unlikely that they would expand it, though you'd think they might keep it, Rudy.
Well, they never talk about cost, right? After this many years in power, I think people recognize that the pattern is great on announcement, great headline, yes, great idea, and then that's it. You know, they'll see what the results are in the poll, and then they'll be distracted and do something else. There's just no follow through. And that's why I think this plan has been greeted with, you know, it's a muted greeting, right? Because it's like, yeah, give us some details. Who's going to pay for it? How does it work? No details.
It's interesting the way that I've heard it explained by liberals, I guess, is that they're saying, gee, I mean, diabetes certainly is an epidemic, and the Conservatives, you know, even if they get into power, won't be able to take it away from people. Do you agree with that analysis, Anthony?
It's likely. It's harder to take something away once it's been given. But if the provinces aren't buying in, if Alberta and Quebec aren't going to do it, there won't be a lot to take away. They're asking for the dollars rather than the care plan provided by the federal government. But the Liberals in 2019, they spent years with Dr. Hoskins bringing out their PharmaCare framework, and they didn't act on it. They saw what it cost, and now they're looking to fill gaps. And I think that's the way to go for most Canadians, is to fill the gaps, find those who are in need, and make sure they have access.
Hmm. another thing affecting Canadians, particularly those that are in that age group right before 65 when things start to get covered for you. A new poll finds that more than half of them are realizing their savings won't be enough to cover their costs, let alone all those, you know, Tuscany or Provence. Daryl, what about that?
Well, I haven't seen that poll, but it's not a surprise. I mean, polls have been showing that for a long time, particularly particularly in the more recent period in which people are really struggling with cost of living. And that's why cost of living issues are at the top of the political agenda right now when you go out and ask Canadians what they're most concerned about. And people who are moving into a stage of their life in which they're going to be modifying their income due to retirement are likely to be most concerned. Although you also find young people are often very concerned about whether they're going to be able to do something in their lives. But as long as cost of living is at the top of the list, these numbers shouldn't be surprising.
The thing that always accompanies polls like this is a pitch by financial advisors sort of saying, don't worry, we'll help you get on track. But when I look at these things and at some of the numbers or the lack of numbers involved, I'm shaking my head.
Well, actually, somebody needs to help people get it on track. So, you know, good on whoever sponsored the poll reflect back to Canadians what they're thinking, at least half of them are. And then if they've got a solution to help them out, why not? I mean, good on them. But the issue that they're dealing with, I think, is much bigger than simply helping people plan for retirement. It's this belief that the country is on the wrong track. Things are just getting more expensive all the time. People's horizon in terms of how they see their lives has become much shorter than it used to be. And their eyes have moved very far down that hierarchy of needs. And it's much more survival-oriented these days than it was back in the good old days. And I don't say this with any irony, back in 2019, prior to the pandemic.
I think, you know, the pandemic has shocked everyone. It's clearly one of those life-changing events where people have time to reflect on where, you know, where they are and where they're going. When I speak to our members from coast to coast, financial insecurity is a big issue. There's a real fear of outliving one's savings. We're in a new period in humanity where we're, after retirement, people are living 20, 30, 40 years longer, something that no one has anticipated. And what I've learned from both personal experience and from working with CARP is, you know, people kind of at the personal level walk into 55 and think, well, maybe I should start planning, where most planners say, no, you should start planning for retirement when you start working. But we all put it off with human nature. And what's happened with the cost of living, it's forced everybody to confront it a lot earlier than they would have expected.
Well, speaking of the cost of living, the issue of food prices seems to be front and center. We're reading about the big grocery, I'll call them oligopolies, expanding their discount brands, but people blame them a lot. I've seen some absolutely eye-popping price increases on things where I don't know why, because that particular commodity didn't go up, as far as I know. And people also want some kind of regulation of grocery prices from Ottawa.
Rudy and I were just talking about regulation.
Yeah. Well, I mentioned my time in I remember the time of wage and price controls and of the previous Trudeau era. And
right.
What everyone discovers is it's easier to control wages than prices. And in the 90s, I was working in Moscow during the Soviet period and walked into grocery stores that were perfectly price controlled. And there wasn't much to buy and it wasn't very good, but the prices were reasonable. We're in a market economy. I think that grocery prices reflect the cost of living. That's where people confront the reality of it. They don't look at Bank of Canada numbers on that. That's abstract. But it's the reality of it, exacerbated by the fact that we have an oligopoly. We have lack of competition in Canada. That doesn't help, but I don't think that's the core issue.
Yeah, but I think that it's almost a knee-jerk thing, Anthony, that people want Ottawa to do something
about
this.
Well, they want to blame the grocery stores, but Ottawa's policies, I think, have led to it. We have supply management in the dairy industry that really causes prices not to be competitive. We have carbon taxes on fuel that have dramatically increased the cost of delivering and transporting these goods across a massive country. And when, you know, oil prices aren't going up the same as diesel gas prices because of the carbon taxes on top of them, that leads to increases across the board. And then the employees fight for increases to their salaries because they can't afford the prices as they're going up, and that's the inflation spiral.
Daryl, what are you finding in terms of the issue of grocery prices?
Yeah, people are really concerned about it. They really want to blame somebody, and they really want somebody to do something about it. Exactly what the solution is, they're not really sure. But as in so many things in Canada, when we've got a problem, the place that we go to solve it is government. So that's why the pressure has increased on governments.
Wow, yeah. I was walking in my neighborhood. This is a first world thing, you know, past a bakery that's popular. And normally, if you even want to spend the money for a bread after 2 or 3 in the afternoon, forget about it. Well, I looked in the window and I saw, gee, they have a lot of breads left. They had raised the price to $7.99.
For a loaf of bread.
For a nice loaf of bread, but $7.99. I think it was probably $5.50 before, which is a lot.
Yeah, it's amazing. You know, it was with the after the pandemic, when everyone understood that there was this change, we should pay more for labor and everything, and bars and restaurants and hotels took a hit, and then it was like, immediately, some people, some companies, some industries started raising prices. And I think everyone jumped in and realized, let's do it all now. Let's everybody raise their prices now, because they won't be able to single out a single industry. But I'm shocked, too, when I go to the store for basics, you know, things that you know what they should cost or what they have been costing. And you see the price, and it's unbelievable. I just don't know, you know, I don't know where this is going to end.
Yeah. Now I want to talk about the chatbot, okay? and how businesses are moving to these to save money, and you can lose business like this. So indulge me, and people, let me give the numbers out again. So tell me if you've had a bad experience going around in circles with a chatbot. 416-360-0740, toll free 1-866-740-4740. So we needed to rent a little cube van to move a piece of furniture, and we hadn't done it in advance. And our friends who were doing this with us said, oh, we know a really good U-Haul place, but it was halfway across town. So I thought, you know, I've used an enterprise very close to the house in the past. I called them. We made arrangements. No problem. So I try calling them, and it takes forever, right? You have to go through this whole menu. Then when you finally get to the prompt that will allow you to get to a human, you have to wait. And it was a prompt that said you can get to your neighborhood location. But no, I got to a call center. And the person who answered the phone made it sound like it was my fault. And she said, well, do it again. The prompt is there. I then went through the whole thing again and did it again and got the same result. And finally I said, you know what? It's just going to be easier to drive across town, which is a whole other story. So I'm thinking, you know, customer service has been terrible lately. And what about all these companies that are blindly moving to these things? And frankly, a lot of times they just don't work, Daryl.
Well, what they're doing is making space for their competition. So that's how this ends up getting disciplined, is somebody will see that space in the market, will hear your story today and say, you know what, I've got a solution for that. And it may not be technology-oriented. Maybe it's a personal service type of an orientation.
Oh, it did. We drove across town. We called them. They answered the phone. A human answered the phone. He said, yes, we can rent you a van. It has to be back by 1 p.m. We rushed over there, and everything was just peachy. And there were three young men in that particular office, and they were very helpful. And, yeah, that's how it was solved, Daryl.
Yeah, well, and that's how modern economies actually going back for a very long time, solve problems. If you do a crappy job, people don't, unless you're in a regulated position, which is interesting why, you know, when we raise a regulation is the way to deal with these problems, unless you're protected by regulations, because remember, regulations help the regulated. They don't necessarily help the customers. And so unless you're in a market situation in which customer satisfaction actually plays a role in terms of the price of the service that's being provided or even the provision of that service, unless you have that market signal, you know, there's no way you can fix that situation. And that's why markets work, because somebody's got a service in place now that you will go to the next time and you won't be back to the other place. And maybe every other customer who goes through the same circumstance will do the same thing, which then forces them to change.
Well, you know, I think that's the theory, but I've seen some places, and I'm not going to get back to the grocery stores, where the customer service is not good and people are there because they're convenient.
Well, yeah, you just put up with it. And so the thing that you calculate is it worth the bother? And the answer is, I'm not happy, but it isn't. But the minute somebody opens something up next door that deals with that problem and then does everything else as well as the place that you're going, are you going to stay?
Good question. Good question. We have a few minutes left, so let's talk about it's spring cleaning time, this donation thing. I mean, the reason we rented a van was moving a dining room table. And I'd like to hear from people, their experiences. If first of all, maybe you have things that you want to try to give to your family or friends. That is a very difficult sell these days. And even if you want to donate it, you cannot be sure where it's going to end up and whether it even ends up out of a landfill.
Yeah, I had the same problem when I was clearing out my mom's house, trying to give up. She had really great furniture, but it wasn't the style that I was interested in, nor did I need it. And it was really hard to give it away. We finally went to a local neighborhood Facebook page and let people know, like, there's a great dining bedroom set, matching set for anyone that's willing to come and get it. But that was it was really hard. It was after we'd gone through a lot of different steps to try to give it away. First you think, oh, well, maybe we should try to sell it. Well, forget that, you know. And then you settle with anyone with a truck that's willing to come and take it. And fortunately, we found a good family for it. But it's really difficult because a lot of people, you know, younger people are in smaller places. They don't want their parents' furniture, their friends' furniture.
They don't like that heavy wood look.
Yeah. Who knows? You know, in 50 years' time, of course, they'll be looking for the next generation will be looking for something their grandparents had or their great-grandparents. But
well, pro tip, there are, for furniture, there are charities like Habitat for Humanity, which if you have something good, they'll pick it up. They'll even give you a tax receipt. But the other thing that I'm finding from people, including my husband and friends of ours, is that they want to know that their stuff is going to a good home.
And unfortunately, it's less likely to do that. There's an entire industry growing up around the GTA now for storage facilities where boomers are storing things that they want to keep, and they're paying high monthly bills to store these things. And it's a terrible
ridiculous
investment, because once they're gone, the stuff will disappear eventually anyways.
Well, yeah, and it's not just that. I mean, there's this relatively new industry, Daryl, of people picking up your, you know, junk. It's not necessarily junk, but suddenly we've gone from a place where you could actually sell things and make a few bucks where you have to pay.
Yeah, no, and I use them too. I mean, but around where I live, if you put something out in the front around garbage day, somebody comes up and picks it up and takes it by 2 a.m. anyway, so it tends to go away. But, I mean, this is why, you know, they've got those shows like Swedish Death Cleaning and things of that nature. I mean, when you get older, you have to start thinking about, do you really want to stick your kids with having to deal with all of this stuff? Maybe you should deal with it. You probably have more time on your hands, and you know what will be really valuable to your kids. Maybe hold on to that, but this other stuff that you don't need, get rid of it.
And the stuff seems to be less important. I mean, the stuff, it's not stuff at our place. My husband inherited furniture, and there was one particular piece that was very meaningful for him. And it was very awkward, but I would never have asked him to get rid of it. Suddenly, when an opportunity came up, he said, oh, I have no attachment to this. And I'm thinking, we've had this for 35 years, and I remember you having a big attachment to it. So people do change on that note.
It does. It's about life's change. I felt the same way when we were clearing out our house in Toronto to make a move to Vancouver. But we had a year's time to start putting things out on the curb, right? Oh. So we could put it on the curb. If you have the time to give it away, it works. But after a year of it, we still had all this other stuff. And the thing that I thought about is, why did we buy this in the first place? You know, half the things you look at, you think, why did I buy this? Now I've got to deal with it. And maybe it's our materialistic selves, you know, as you get older, you realize what's really valuable. Yeah.
Well, we only have a few minutes left. Are you getting rid of anything, Anthony?
I'm not, but I've gone through the process with my aging parents, and the conversation is important to have with the boomers and their adult children on what we're keeping, what we're not keeping, and the value, sentimental or otherwise, but the planning ahead for those downsizing times, very important, whether it's an acute change in lifestyle or it's gradual, planning ahead is the best
thing. The kids don't want anything.
They don't want it.
They don't want anything. Daryl, how about you?
Well, you know, it is interesting when you look at the what people actually do with downsizing. They actually don't downsize that much. There's this view that what happens is you retire and you get rid of your house and you move out. That's actually not what happens.
Right.
Most people stay right where they are.
Until the age of
85.
Yeah, 85. Yeah.
So.
I can't deal with moving this stuff. I'm staying put.
But when you look at the data on this, it's also that's where people feel comfortable. They feel satisfied. It's where they like to live. They're not doing it because they have to. They're doing it because they want to.
Hear, hear. We've been advocating for that for a long time.
Aging in place.
Yep. Aging in place. A conversation that we've had many times and will have many times again in the meantime. Thank you so much, Daryl Bricker, Rudy Boutignol, and Anthony Quinn.
Thanks, Libby.
Thanks.
Thanks.
Bye-bye. We are going to take a break, and when we come back, a very difficult conversation on the horrible sexual violence perpetrated against Israeli women by Hamas on October the 7th, when we return.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to 1. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Welcome back. With International Women's Day around the corner coming up this week, a very special visitor is here in Toronto. Professor Ruth Halperin-Kadari is director of the Rackman Center for the Advancement of the Status of Women at Bar-Ilan University. And since the horrific October 7th Hamas attack, she has been working to get the international community to recognize and address the terrible sexual violence perpetrated against Israeli women during that event. We are talking about systematic rape, mutilation, and murder, and the details are beyond sickening, and I have to apologize to our audience. And after it happened, many pro-Hamas, pro-Palestinian advocates either denied it happened or cheered it. And since the massacre, as I said, Professor Halperin-Kadari has held special meetings at the UN and played a key role in securing the fact-finding mission in Israel by the UN Secretary General's Special Representative for Sexual Violence in Conflict. She joins me now. Welcome and thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
So what was your reaction? We were all so shocked about both the attack, but the sexual violence. What was your first reaction to it?
At first, I found it really hard to believe because I never imagined that fate of women in other parts of the world, to which I was exposed to during my 12 years on the UN Committee on the Elimination of Discrimination Against Women, women in Bosnia, in Rwanda, in Syria, Iraq, Yazidi women, that same fate would actually become part of the fate of Israeli women. But I realized that human cruelty can go beyond imagination and that we are facing an enemy that has absolutely no limits. And our role is to expose the truth and to tell the world this had really happened.
There was so much evidence. What was your reaction that people were actually denying this?
That was also beyond comprehension. The atrocities committed by Hamas on October 7 were probably the most recorded crime, war crime, crime against humanity in world history. They broadcasted everything that they did in real time and put it on social media and sent it to families of the victims. And then just one day afterwards, together with their allies, the Islamic Republic of Islamic regime of Iran and Russia, they engaged in deleting all these evidence, the footage and the photographs, and started the most sinister campaign of denial. And unfortunately, a lot of people who have difficulties in changing their mind frame and in realizing that the organization, the terror organization that purports to be the representative of the Palestinian people, that they had indeed committed these crimes and that Israel had been a victim to the most horrific crime possible.
Do you think that a lot of that denial was because of anti-Semitism?
I think it has to do with anti-Semitism. It has to do with the double standard that so many within the international human rights community and also among UN agencies, the double standard that they hold against Israel. But there had also been some difficulties in having evidence because of the satanic plan of Hamas to leave no living survivors. The vast majority of the victims who had been assaulted were murdered immediately after or even during the sexual assault, and thus they were silenced forever. But we have no way of collaborating with this plan to keep silence. We have to be the voice for those victims who were silenced forever.
You've mentioned the bias against Israel at many UN agencies. So what made you decide to try to take them on and convincing, and how did that go?
I believe that by keeping silent or by their delayed, very, very delayed response, they not only failed Israel and Israeli women, they failed the whole humanity. I believe that they really worked against their duty and their obligation. And being part of the international human rights community as a past former vice president of the CEDAW committee, I felt this was my role to call them to order and to call them to fulfill their obligation to protect and to promote the human rights of all women of the whole world, and this was and still is not a difficult task, but I do have to point out that the United Nations is not one monolithic institute, and there are several agencies within the United Nations who are able to hold a more complex and nuanced understanding of the reality. And one such agency, as you mentioned at the beginning, is the Special Representative of the Secretary General on Sexual Violence in Conflict, Ms. Pramela Patten, whose report on her fact-finding mission to Israel that was conducted just last month, and I had the privilege of also accompanying her during that visit. Her report is just about to be published an hour from now. She will hold a press conference. And I truly believe that after this report is being published, it will no longer be possible for anybody to claim that it did not happen.
So in order to get her to undertake that fact-finding mission, was it just a matter of you dealing with her, or did you have to go through layers of bureaucracy? I just want to get a sense of how it happened.
This was, of course, a formal visit. She was formally invited by the government of Israel through the Secretary General, and it had to go through all the formal and diplomatic channels and venues. And the report that will be published now is an official UN report. And the main findings of this report will be included in the annual report of the Secretary General that will be published in March, the annual report on 2023, that always has a section on sexual violence in conflict. And the Secretary General, too, realized that it will be simply impossible to publish such a report on 2023 without addressing October 7 and the sexual violence that was committed by Hamas against Israel on that day.
Have you seen the report? Are you confident that it will have everything that actually happened?
No, I have not seen it yet. But as I said before, I accompanied her during the visit and I had discussions with her and her team, and I expect it to confirm perhaps not everything that we have indications for, but I expect it to confirm the main facts that sexual violence and gender atrocities were part of Hamas attack on October 7th.
And what are you hoping to accomplish with your visit here?
I aim to raise awareness of like-minded countries and governments to this very difficult aspect of Hamas attack on Israel, and to proceed not just with recognizing Hamas as a terrorist organization, but also to go after its allies, such as the Islamic regime of Iran and Russia, and to also realize that this has caused a surge in anti-Semitic attacks against Jewish population, including in Canada, and to realize that we are facing a new reality, a very dangerous reality for democracies throughout the world, and not just Israel.
There's an image that stays with me and with many other people from the day of the attacks, and that is that young woman, bloodied young woman being pushed along by Hamas as being kidnapped. So are any of the sexual violence victims still alive in Gaza, as far as you know?
We hope and pray that they are still alive, but sadly, we have indications, as also reported by hostages that have returned from captivity in Gaza, that sexual violence is still going on in captivity. And every time that I recall this image that you recounted now, I am brought to tears. and I just pray that they will return to us immediately, and will, with the help of everybody and with the help of God, will be able to overcome this horrific trauma to which they were exposed.
Sorry to bring that up. Is there anything else you'd like to leave us with?
It's very difficult, as you suggested at the beginning. It is hard to believe, and I also think that perhaps people just prefer not to think about it because it is too hard. But it is our duty of everybody to face the reality, to face the truth, and not to get eluded by fake propaganda and by fake news, and to take responsibility and face the reality that there is evil in the world, and there are enemies that know no limits, and we all have to unite in facing them together.
Thank you so much, Professor Ruth Halperin-Kadari. Appreciate that.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye. Difficult conversation. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, more money talk. A lot of people have lost track of their pensions because of changing jobs. So we'll talk about how you can figure out if that's happened to you when we return.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Welcome back. With finances so tight for so many people, it's hard to imagine losing track of a sure thing, but that is what's happened to nearly 200,000 pension plan members who lost track of their plans. Now, that number is from the Financial Services Regulatory Authority of Ontario. And that agency figures that there are 3 billion, that's billion with a B, in associated benefits that are stranded because of this. Now, you can kind of figure that if you change jobs a lot, something may have gone astray, and sometimes there are errors involved. So the numbers to call, 416-360-0740, toll free 1-866-740-4740. And now let's go to Kurt Rosentreter, Senior Financial Advisor and Portfolio Manager at Manulife Wealth. Hi, Kurt.
Hi, Libby. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you for coming on. So how can something like this happen?
It happens a lot. I've been in the industry 30 years in financial services. I'm also a chartered accountant, so you know, pensions tend to be something we look at a lot. And I find that there's probably, as much as in some cases people lose track of it with their employer, there's probably like 5 or 6 different examples that I can outline of when money goes missing, so to speak. You know, and just to kind of lay them out, in one case where, you know, the employer just says, no, sorry, you didn't work here, like that can happen when, as you said, you can change employers a lot, and they dispute it. Maybe, I think that's more common with smaller businesses where their records may not be as great, but it can happen. Two, you've got a bankrupt employer who effectively makes it even more challenging to get the information out related to your pension because now they're arguably gone and all the people are laid off. Three, if you take a leave of absence and you're gone for an extended period of time, that can create gaps in employment history that can make this more challenging. Four, job change. They say research shows now we may have as many as 6 different careers by the time we retire and shut it down. So again, different pensions. And lastly, divorce and even financial hardship can cause differences in pensions that result in a lot of complexity that the average consumer may struggle with.
Can't people or couldn't people port their pension?
They can. So in a lot of cases, when you leave an employer, or even when you retire, the organization will engage often an actuarial firm that will determine whether or not, okay, A, do you want to keep your pension there and start to claim it, say it's 65? Two, do you want to keep your pension there and maybe take it early? Three, do you want to take it out and transfer to investment savings? And four, if you're going to another employer that has the same kind of pension, can you actually port it and integrate it into the new pension plan? So it's not uncommon when people leave their employer to see three, four, five, six different options that can be a bit overwhelming. I probably do one engagement a week where I'm helping someone sort through what the best options are for their personal circumstances.
And do people just forget that they have this pension from this company? Is that the problem?
Absolutely right. Like in most cases, the most common situation is people just forget where they worked 30 years later, 20 years later, 10 years later. They may not even remember they had a pension plan. And if they've moved and their address was never updated with the HR department, then they stop getting statements, which also, you know, takes this away from front of mind. When I do estate work after someone's died, and it even gets worse because you're dealing with a survivor who wasn't even the pension beneficiary. Now it's a spouse who has no clue where their partner worked 25 years ago, but may be entitled to spousal support benefits after their death. So it's really important that the public keep track of their employment history, the plans they were part of, and make sure the address is always up to date with the HR department.
You know, you're just making me think, because generally speaking, I opted out of pension plans, but maybe there was one employer many years ago.
Yeah. Well, let me give you one more extension of this.
Yeah.
Here's another dimension of this that, let's say you moved out of the country for a while and you went and worked in the States or in London, England for a few years. You may, you know, let's put pensions aside. You may qualify for their social security system because you worked there long enough to qualify for a pension check for the rest of your life, much like CPP. I run into that one all the time as well.
How long? I worked in the States for a while.
You have to meet their point system. So, but the U.S. Social Security is lucrative. So I ask everybody, did you ever work outside the country? And which countries? And some of these are pretty, you know, significant Social Security benefits. So it's not just pensions. It's really anything that you may have contributed to where you were.
Well, so how many years in the States?
I think it's a point system, if I'm not mistaken. I don't know well, but I think it's like 30 to 40 points, at least 3 years.
Oh,
could
okay.
It could be a lot longer than that.
Oh, okay. All right. I would have thought it'd be very hard to lose track of this stuff, but you're telling me that it was, in fact, it would be pretty easy. Let's take a call from Paul in Brampton. Hello, Paul.
Yeah. Hello.
Hello. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, I was with the local 506 of the Construction Laborers Union in early 80s, and then I left there to the Aerospace Union for about 2 years. That is no longer, I tried to track it down, they're no longer in existence. Yeah, I worked for Air King, a Lasco metal product company out of Philadelphia. Mm-hmm. So I don't know where those pensions are.
So, Paul, what I would suggest is you know, there's an organization that you can contact that Libby mentioned called the Financial Services Regulatory Authority of Ontario. And, you know, they've got a website. It's fsrao.ca. For consumers, they help to sort issues like this out related to pensions. They also govern, just for interesting sake, property and casualty insurance, mortgage brokering, all kinds of different services, but auto insurance. But for you, contacting them, you can literally on their website say, you know, help me to track whether or not even a defunct organization that's gone left assets behind. Because very often what happens is with pension assets, they're custodied, fancy word, they're custodied separate from the business. So if the business goes bankrupt, and you know, a good example where we saw this in recent years was Sears Canada. Sears Canada went bankrupt with the pension funds, a standalone asset base that still ensures that the pensioners get payments. You know, hard to believe this would be any different with the aerospace one for you. And if they've got, you know, the records, they can dig into this. And the reality is pension funds have to file annual documents. So there is an audit trail that may be beyond just the average consumer digging into themselves. But the FSRA is built to really help an advocate on your behalf to sort this out.
Hello.
Okay, good luck with that, Paul. It sounds like it's pretty complicated, but it's good that there's an agency that is there to help. So, Kurt, is that what you recommend for people who want to check? Is that their first stop, FSRA?
Well, the first stop would be trying to contact, if the organization or the pension fund still exists, is go back to them first. And that's usually what I recommend is just see if there's a human resource department, phone number, email, if you can visit if it's local, and just say, hey, I worked for this organization in the 80s, and do you have my records on file? In the vast majority of cases, they will. Like, because payroll is you know, official, you got to do withholdings and stuff. Like, very few companies would not have records going back a long way. Yes, it can be messed up through buyouts and mergers and just changes at the company and bankruptcies. But then I would say that, you know, the Financial Services Regulatory Authority, FSRA, is your backup. Because, you know, they can dig deeper and broader, and they're representing you. But always start with the HR department of the existing organization.
Anything else that you want to tell people? How long a process should they expect? How much time do you have to put into this?
Well, I think before you retire, these are often issues related to retirement, right? You're looking for your pension. So I would say that a good 5 years before you retire, you should start to get organized on all of your, you know, kind of retirement-based assets. So, for example, CPP, Canada Pension Plan, if you've paid into that, call Service Canada, order a history of your CPP benefits back to age 18, and just make sure it looks complete. If you see big gaps, like, okay, well, why is that? And you could talk to them about that. If you took time off for maternity leave, let's say, you may want to talk about whether or not you can be exempt from those years so that you're not getting penalized for it. For pension plans, it's no different. You want to look at your career history back to when we were all teenagers and say, where did I work? How long was I there? And is there an organization that I can go talk to see if I'm entitled to assets? Normally, for most of us, is that in today's world where defined benefit pensions are really not available very often, it's now defined contributions or RSPs. When you leave the employer now, they often say, well, you got to transfer it out. And you got to, use your word, port it to your own RSP or your own investment accounts. That's the common answer nowadays. But in both cases, whether it's a group RRSP, or whether it's a defined benefit plan, the sweet ones that are so guaranteed, either way, going to every employer you had, checking in and saying, do you have anything on file for me for a pension plan, is just smart, just to verify that you're not leaving assets on the table, much the way the government has said people are.
Mm-hmm. And does the magnitude, the numbers involved here, does that surprise you?
No, because I think that the public doesn't really, isn't appreciative of kind of how this stuff is maintained on their behalf. So it's just not something you ever see written about, talked about. And it's pretty easy to kind of, you know, forget what you did 30 years ago, right? But these assets, much like kind of lost bank accounts you hear about now and then orphan bank accounts, this is the same thing. And so the difference is in these cases, these are employers often that knew you. And even if the people have changed, your records are still on file, particularly with electronics today, they can dig it all back. So you have a better likelihood, I think, of recovering this if you put the effort in. But at least 5 years in advance, get organized.
I think that's aspirational, shall we say, 5 years in advance.
But well, I'm a planner, so that's my goal.
Very, very good advice, though. Thank you so much, Kurt.
Thanks,
Rosentreter. Appreciate
Thank
that.
You. Take care. Yeah, bye.
Okay, projects for all of us. And that is all the time we have for today.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.